Accession number 18567, Real 1.
Norman Madden, Real 1. Where were you born, please?
I was born in Exeter.
Which year was this?
1924.
Grew up and have your schooling in Exeter?
Yes.
How old were you when you left school?
I started school when I was 4, actually, in a nursery school.
And how old were you when you left?
14.
So this was 38?
Yes.
Just before the war started. Mm-hmm. Did you get a job?
Yes. I worked for a laundry as a van boy.
Is that what you were doing when war was declared?
Mm-hmm.
Did you hear Neville Chamberlain declare war on Germany?
Yes, I do.
Under what circumstances?
I can picture it now. I can remember seeing a picture in the paper of the plane landing, and he on the steps of the plane coming out with his trilby hat on, waving his paper. I can always stick in my mind that day, of that day. And he averted war. That's one part I can remember quite well.
But do you remember the announcement when he actually declared war on Germany?
No.
How did you feel when you heard the news that England was at war?
I suppose to me, it didn't seem real. I didn't understand war. And I think youngsters of my age, anyway, it just didn't register at all that you was at war. And then after it was announced, I used to go in the back garden looking up in the sky, thinking I was going to see a load of airplanes coming over. Which is unreal, but I mean, at that time, yes, because I never experienced war or anything near that. Yeah.
Did the war affect you at first in any way?
No, I don't think so. Yes, sometimes the bombing at night and all that. And you weren't allowed to stay indoors. I used to take a van out from the laundry and take them out into the country to get out of it at night. But fundamentally, no, I don't think it affected me in any way.
When did you join the army?
I was 18 to the day when they called me up.
So this was 42?
Mm-hmm.
Were you in Exeter when it was badly bombed?
Yes, I was fire watching.
What do you remember about that?
I was fire watching at the laundry, and suddenly we heard these noises like, and got it from the laundry like, and looked, and all you could see was all these flares being dropped. You couldn't see the plane. And the next minute, all hell let loose, like bombs and incendiaries just coming down. And of course the laundry overlooks the railway. And I remember seeing this, though I didn't know at that time, that it was a man coming down on a parachute. And it hit the air raid shelter over on the St. David and killed quite a few. But it was luck of it. So he happened to be there. And then later on, while this was going on, I was trying to get the trains out of St. David, and I always remember seeing this passenger train going out, and the bombs going off, not around him, but it seemed in my mind it was quite near. And he was going through all the smoke, going out of St. David's, letting it get out of it.
Was that going towards London or towards Plymouth?
Yes, towards London. Yeah. That's what I remember mostly in the Blitz.
What was your address in the Blitz?
Number 2 Laundry Cottages. We lived on the premises in Exwick, where the laundry was.
In Exwick?
Yes. Which is just a small suburb in the bottom of the village.
Did many bombs hit Exwick area?
No. One landed at the cemetery in Exwick Road, but that was a landmine. And it hit the cemetery, and the next day you could see all the tombstones and bones all over the road, and the parachute was in the trees.
How frightening did you find the bombing?
Very frightening. Yes.
Were there any people who were killed or injured that you knew?
A couple of friends of mine, their fathers, they got killed on the railway. And then I knew in the younger days, when I lived in Paris Street, which was where the main Blitz were, several of my friends' fathers, they were killed in the Blitz.
How do you think public morale stood up to the bombing in the town?
I thought very well, actually, in my small mind, anyway. Everybody seemed to help everybody else, which I think is lacking today anyway. There was more comradeship. Everybody would help one another. Sort of like a ration, if you was out of sugar, you'd knock on your next door and say, oh, could you lend me a cup of sugar? And they'd lend it to you. I think in my mind, it was far better in those days than it is today. Nobody didn't seem to have much. And so everybody sort of banded together. You knew everybody, you spoke to everybody, and you knew their troubles and they knew yours, and if they could help, they would. And I think it's a totally different era than today. You know, in my mind, I always think today's living, you've got to live up to the Joneses. If they got a television, you got to get a television. If they got a car, you got to get a car. And well, in our days, I mean, you'd go out of the house and you'd leave your front door key hanging on a bit of string behind the door. So when you come home from school, you put your hand in the letterbox, pull the string out, open the door and go in. I mean, you couldn't do that today.
Did you get much crime during the war?
No. No.
Now, can you tell me about being called up to the army, please?
Yes, I had a letter come on my 18th birthday telling me I had to report to Chichester, which is on the south coast. Told me what time train, I think it was somewhere like 11 o'clock in the morning. And when I woke up, I wasn't married then, mind, I was going with Pauline, but we hadn't married. Woke up next morning, I had the biggest face out here with toothache. I had an abs on my tooth and it come right out. And then I was in a lot of pain. But anyway, there was another youngster on the station, at Central Station. Yes, there was another youngster. And he was on the platform. I got talking, and my mother was there. And I said, you join up? He said, oh, yes. So I met, and he was called Ian. I don't know his second name, but he was called Ian. So we went to Chichester together and got off the train. There was a couple of sergeants there and lined us up, and he looked at me and he said, you're in a sorry state. I said, yes, I got an ass. Oh, he said, you wanted that one very long. So we marched us up to this barracks, a garrison. Got in, went through the formalities of form signing and this, that and the other. And this major come along and he looked at me and he said, you're in a lot of pain. I said, yes. He said, when do you have it? I said, it'll come up overnight. Oh, he said, that's quite a while, he said. Just wait there, he said, and I'll get somebody down to you. And he was this captain come down, and he was a dental captain. And he took me up in surgery and said, well, I'm going to take it out. Well, I didn't know in those days whether it was right to take it out with an abs, because today they won't let you take it out. But anyway, he took it out. But he ripped me gums to pieces. And I can honestly say now, I'm scared of going to a dentist. That put me right off.
Did he hurt you?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Did you get anaesthetic?
Yeah, he did inject me, but I did go through a lot of pain on that one. Ripped me gums. But anyway, we got over that. And after about 3 weeks, I was almost myself. Then I got transferred to Colchester. I always remember the barrack name, because in Colchester, their barracks is named after battles or. And my barracks are called Gujarat. I went there, I'd done all my training there.
What was that like?
I found it very good. It's hard to believe. I enjoyed every minute of it. It was. I'm one of these that like to do something. I get bored very easily, so if I'm doing things, I'm quite happy. And I found army life was quite good. Yes, you're away from home, but you're with a lot of youngsters, and I call it, you know, people my age, and we have a laugh at night. Like, and yes, sometimes you may go off to cinema if you could afford it, but most times you couldn't. And there was so much to do which you couldn't do in civilian life. That's where I found it anyway. And they had these rocket launchers around the barracks, and they'd send up about 50, 60 rockets at a time. You go, especially when there's air raids on at Colchester, which happened nearly every night. And I was always fascinated with this. And they had a big military police camp for defaulters, and we used to sit up on the balcony and watch them in, over the wall, running everywhere. They weren't allowed to walk. And I'd done my training at Colchester. And then I was very friendly with our sergeant. He was quite a nice man, actually. And he always said to me, if somebody asks you, or asks us, they want volunteers, he said, step out of line that you're going to do it. That's if I may not like it. He said, you will. Anyway, a couple of days later, he said, I want 6 volunteers. I thought, sorry, somebody has stepped out. 4 have stepped out. He said, I want 2 more. 2 more volunteers. Wait a few minutes, he said, right, you and you. So he had 2 others. Well, that was a turning point to me of more enjoyment. We were sent to Shrewsbury, which is the Sentinel Works. They make tanks and Sentinel carriers and Bren gun carriers. And I went on that course, and that's where I learned to drive everything. It was the finest move I ever made. It was enjoyable. You learnt the mechanics of the tanks and the Bren gun carriers. You drove them over assault courses, and I thoroughly enjoyed it. And I thought, thank God I volunteered for this.
You were in the Royal Armoured Corps, were you?
Not when I started, no. I was in the Duke of Cornwall's Light Infantry when I first joined the Army. That was when I got to Colchester. And then I took this course, volunteering. And I'd done all my passing it up there, and I'd done quite well. I had a proficiency pay for being one of the best trainees, I suppose. Because you had a thing in the Army, that if you passed so-and-so, you get X number of pence per day more. So the more you pass, the more money you got. I done quite well on that. And from there, I got put back to Colchester. And then it was coming up to the building up for the D-Day, which we didn't know then.
What unit were you in by now?
I was still in the second... when I went back to Colchester, I went to the 2nd Devons Regiment. I wasn't in there very long. Then they transferred me to the 7th Armoured Division. So we went down to Southampton, or near Southampton anyway, on the cliffs. And there was quite a few of us. We were taught how to put all this plastic. I always liked plasticine, but it was better than that. So you made your tank waterproof. still not thinking about D-Day, as I won't even mention. And then you, inside the tank, it would be wired up, and then you press a just a little button like that, and all this would fly off the tank. But it would stop the tank from being submerged in water and sinking. So they used to take us down near Southampton. And after you'd done your tank, you had to drive it in the water to make sure that you'd done a good job of it. I mean, not only me, it's five of us with a tank. And try it out to see if it was waterproof.
Was it?
Yeah, very good it was. I wouldn't say you could take a tank from here to, from Dover to Cali. No, not like that. But it was that they wanted it watertight for at least 10 minutes. Yes, you'd have little trickles coming in, but I mean, not gushing that it would upset the engine or anything like that. Then we just drive it out, like, to the under, not the whole tank in under, but most far of it, and see how many trickles there was, and then you back it out again, and they blow it off, and you start off again until you got it. It was a knack of doing it, actually, with your thumb and pushing it all in, but I enjoyed it. And I was trying to think of our colonel. I don't know, he's called Jeffries or something like that anyway. And he was a stickler for everything had to be right. Well, I don't know what you do understand, but with a tank, there's no linkage exactly the same on either track. You may have 178 links on one side, you may have only 174 on another. It all depends how many times you've turned the tank. If you turn it to the right, then the outside track is doing less work than the inside track, where the inside track is sliding, so you're wearing it. And there's no tank the same. You could never say, oh, you can only do 78 links, you can only do 76. And our colonel, I always remember it, used to line you up front of your tanks. How many links? Well, you got used to it, I used to count them, actually. And then he sent his second lieutenant, that was right in the old days, he said, right, check it. What's your speedometer reading? And you can go in and check your speedometer reading. Maybe only 50 on the thing, or depends on who knew your tank was. But he was a stickler for that sort of thing, of everything had to be right and you had to know what you was doing.
What kind of tanks were they?
Shermans. And it was built up for D-Day. And then on June the 1st, I think it was June the 1st, on May, we were not allowed to write home to say where you were. Every letter would be read by your lieutenant. You were not allowed to disclose where you were in the country. You could write home and say everything was fine and weather and what have you, but no destination, and the letter could not be sealed, it had to be left open so that they could read it. So that went on for nearly a month.
Where were you by now?
I was near Southampton, on the Downs near Southampton, actually. We were all in under tents. There was hundreds of thousands of spectators, I knew. Everywhere you looked, there was tanks and lorries and brain carriers, water carriers. And anyway, on June the 1st, they said that D-Day was coming up, didn't know where, and we were took into a big, massive great tent in my eyes anyway, and they was explaining, didn't say where we were going to, because D-Day was coming up, it was imminent, but there would be no worries. Because when we landed on the beach, there would be nothing there. The planes would be in 12 hours of bombing by planes. The Navy would be shelling it from the channel. So it would be a walkover. I always remember this. So I had my little mind thinking like, oh, it's going to be a picnic. Anyway, June the 4th come, took down, put on these big boats. And the landing craft, was in the boats, and some were lifted out of the water under the davits of the boats. But we were on this big boat, and we went in on June the 4th. I think it was in the afternoon, or in the afternoon. And I was up on the deck looking at it. I've never seen so many boats in my life, big boats, small boats, you name it. It was thousands of boats. And I didn't know where we were heading from, and nobody would tell us. They said, tomorrow we would be landing. It would be the invasion. About 10 o'clock, I think it was, in the evening, everything seemed to stop, and the boats turned around. And I said to one of the person, I said, well, what's going wrong? He said, I don't know. He said, well, you seem to be turning. And as we're going into the beach, like turning, which it seemed. Then we come back, we're coming to, I remember seeing the Isle of Wight, and we were straight out there. I said, no, the invasion had been postponed to tomorrow. You want to load, they wouldn't take you off the boats. And at night, you were battened down under. There was no smoking at night. No smoking up on deck for the evening. And then it come June the 5th, the old thing started off again. And we used to think, oh, it'll be cancelled again. And the weather wasn't very good. And about 5 o'clock in the morning, I was up on deck then. And I'm sure it was the battleship Repulse, we passed. And he was straight in the channel with other naval boats, but the Repulse stands out in my memory because I can remember seeing his name. And he was firing these shells over, whether it was just big shells, a 16-inch, but he was on and there was broadsiding them. And the old boat used to rock when we passed it at night. And they seemed to be firing over us. And it seemed non-stop in my mind. I thought, well, nobody can be alive when we land. Nowhere in the world. It's just going to be off the boat, drive up, thing. And whatever the troop landing crafts is lowered. I think it was about 5:45 in the morning. I was in my tank, and we drove off a tank landing craft, and up the beach, and all hell let loose. It was unbelievable that so many people could have survived the onslaught that they had. I mean, the bombers was going over and bombing, you could see it. And it seemed non-stop, but nobody could ever live under the bombs that was dropped. It seemed hours and hours of bombing. There was going always, we were going up a channel or over towards Bayer and Harry Manchester, which I didn't know at that time where we were going. And these bombers were just endless in the sky. You could see them. And I thought, well, can't be. We're going to land there and there's going to be nobody there anyway. Well, like I say, when we landed, I've never seen so much in my mind that anybody could live through that and get up and give us the biggest hiding we ever had, because that's how I looked at it. That was unbelievable.
You mean the amount of enemy fire?
Yeah. It was unbelievable. Yeah. I was scared, believe me. Because I was only, what? I was 19 then.
Were projectiles hitting your tank?
No, I was one of the lucky ones. I didn't get caught on that one. I did later on, but I seen quite a, I suppose in my mind, over 100 injured, killed of ours. Quite a few tanks was lost.
Which beach did you land on?
Gove Beach.
And when your tank came off the landing craft, how deep did it sink into the sea?
Almost up to the conning tower, and I call it my turret. I always call it my conning tower because we had my periscope. I would say we were in the water maybe 3-4 minutes. Not long. Because you had a big exhaust at the back of your tank to take your exhaust from your engine, otherwise you'd have swapped it. And then you pressed the button and all the stuff flew off. And you kept going, but you couldn't go far because you had a beachhead and the troops couldn't go far enough in front. So it was no good pushing everybody onto a small beach and not being able to move. So they held a lot back till they moved forward, which... So I moved up the beach, no more than about 100 yards. I had to stop and we were firing. There was a machine gun post in the front on like a pillbox, concrete, big concrete pillbox. And shells was coming over, and mortars, and looks was screaming. And yes, there was quite a few was killed and injured. Red Cross was going around, the Army Red Cross, like, you know, shouting, medics here, stretchers here. And it was just, well, hell to me. I didn't think I'd ever come out of this. But anyway, they brought in the flame throwers, and this was two men in our part, anyway. And they opened up with their flame throwers onto these pillboxes, and I stopped that part of the machine. The machine gun's firing, so they was able to move forward. And when they got to the pillbox, I was all watching this through the tank, like. And as he passed the pillbox, they'd be throwing grenades in. Anyway, we got through that part of it, then we got to a place called Arromanches.
Before you go on further, what rank did you have at the time?
Just an ordinary. I didn't go up the ladder until later.
You were a trooper, are you?
At the start, yes.
And who were you driving the tank?
Yeah.
Who was in the tank with you?
There were three of us in the tank.
Do you remember the other two?
Taffy Williams.
What was he doing?
He was a gunner. And then Taffy is a gunner. I was a driver. I'm trying to get the other youngster he was. There was an Irish bloke he was. There was a nice kitty.
What job did he do?
He was, well, almost a second gunner to me. I used to drive, he used to watch it through the periscope, because you never, when you drove your tank, you never had your turrets open. Not in war, anyway. So he had the periscope.
What kind of armament did the Sherman have?
I had a 3.5. Shells, two machine guns on the tank, one in the front, which Taffy and the other block used to manage. It was beside of me. Just trying to think how many shells we carried in the turret. In the turret, completely round, was inside the turret was all your shells all the way round. And under your shells is all your ammunition, all the way around, in belts. So as soon as you put a shell, you take a shell, bang, in, and go on there. It's like a shell being come here.
No, don't worry about pictures, yeah. But... And when you landed in the sea,